Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, we'll have some election returns on Proposition 50, the Poway recall, and some key national races. If you're planning on flying anywhere anytime soon, you'll want to listen to our show today. The FAA has ordered cutbacks in flights because of the federal shutdown at 40 airports, including right here in San Diego. The food bank held a massive food distribution at Snapdragon Stadium as SNAP benefits end temporarily due to the federal shutdown. If you need food or you can help, listen up to our show today. On Crime Beat, a driver who fled the scene after seriously injuring a 12-year-old child has been arrested and has a very high bail set. El Cajon police have identified the victim in a cold case homicide decades after it occurred. We'll tell you how they did it on our show today. In Descanso, businesses and community members are speaking out over Caltrans slashing the number of parking spaces in the business district. Grossmont Healthcare District has a new CEO. Find out who on our show today. Then from California News Service, we'll have a report on toxic wildfire smoke. And if you live in Lakeside, the county wants input on a proposed Lakeside transportation plan. On 2025 Talks, from Public News Service, we'll have some national news today, including former Speaker Nancy Pelosi announcing she will not run for re-election to Congress, protests by U.S. Postal Service workers, and more. On our arts and music segment today, we'll have an interview with a La Mesa filmmaker and director, Elisha Cecil, who has a film coming up that you can see at San Diego Film Week. On Destination East County, hear about the fun and festive events coming up across East County this month, from turkey trots and theater plays to events heralding in the start of the holiday season. From Public News Service's Yonder Report, hear how tariffs are impacting rural communities, how farmers are coping with USDA offices being closed due to the shutdown, ICE raids in rural areas, and more. And finally on Green Scene, hear about a pumpkin smash event held at a local school to teach children about sustainability. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show, where East County matters.
California voters have decisively approved Proposition 50, which will allow temporary redistricting of the state's congressional districts for the next 5 years. Statewide, around 65% of voters cast votes for Prop 50, with 35% opposed. Locally, 61% of San Diego County voters supported the redistricting measure, with 39% opposed. Prop 50 allows the state's legislature to redraw congressional district lines, bypassing the state's redistricting commission midway between census reports. The action aims to elect more Democrats to Congress in order to counter Republican gerrymandering of districts in Texas and other states. Locally, passage means Republican Congressman Darrell Issa's conservative district is slated to be redrawn to span inland and coastal areas, in a move Democrats hope may give them an edge in the November 2026 elections. The measure is being closely watched at the national level. Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin issued a statement blaming President Donald Trump for trying to stay in power by rigging the midterm congressional elections. "We don't roll over when one team refuses to play by the rules. We fight back," the DNC chair said. Californians stood up, rallied together, and passed Proposition 50 to make sure voters, not Donald Trump, decide who represents them in Congress. Martin says Trump fears losing midterm seats because, quote, "Instead of building the economy, he's building a ballroom. Instead of fixing health care, he's throwing out-of-touch parties with his ultra-wealthy friends. And now he's staring down the consequences of his corrupt, failed presidency." National Republican Congressional Committee Chairman Richard Hudson had this to say on passage of Prop 50. No matter how Democrats redraw the lines to satisfy Gavin Newsom's power grab, they can't redraw their record of failure, and that's why they will fail to take the House majority. Even under this new map, Republicans have clear opportunities to flip seats because Californians are fed up with Democrat chaos. Nationwide, Democrats swept local mayor races in Tuesday's election in a stinging rebuke of the Trump MAGA agenda amid a shutdown that's left millions of Americans without access to SNAP food benefits and health care premiums skyrocketing due to Republicans' refusal to extend affordable health care tax credits that just expired. Virginia and New Jersey elected women Democratic governors, while New York City rejected Trump-endorsed Mario Cuomo for mayor, instead electing Zohran Mamdani, a Democratic socialist. And in Cincinnati, Vice President J.D. Vance's brother lost his bid to becoming mayor by a stunning 80-20% margin, despite, or perhaps because, of his famous brother's endorsement. Locally, Poway voters opted to overwhelmingly recall scandal-plagued District 2 Councilmember Tony Blaine by an 81-19% margin. Blaine is facing charges including perjury and soliciting bribes. A military officer and doctor who was just elected to the Poway City Council last December, Blaine defeated a fellow Republican to win the seat. His most prominent endorsement came from Assemblymember Carl DeMaio. Blaine has been accused of trading votes for favors in apparent violation of state law, also threatening and harassing city staff members and officials, according to Voice of San Diego. The city council took the rare step of censuring Blaine in February and then in April filed a lawsuit against him for allegedly destroying public records and using an encrypted app for city business. NBC7 reports Blaine was recently deployed overseas and has not been available to comment on his legal woes or on being recalled overwhelmingly by voters in his Eastern Poway district. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
San Diego International Airport is among 40 airports across the U.S. that have been forced to cut flights effective November 7th under order of the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, due to the federal government shutdown. Air traffic controllers have been working without pay for weeks due to the failure of Congress to enact a funding measure to end the shutdown. Some have taken outside jobs and have been calling in sick, resulting in flight delays. This past week, there were more than 2,700 delays at various airports, according to the FAA. A 4% reduction in operations takes effect November 7th, ramping up to 6% by November 13th and 10% by November 14th. Just in time for the busy Thanksgiving holiday travel season, if the shutdown is not resolved by then. FAA Administrator Brian Bedford says, "We are seeing signs of stress in the system, so we are proactively reducing the number of flights to make sure the American people continue to fly safely." He adds that the FAA will continue to closely monitor operations and take further action if needed. Airlines will be required to issue full refunds for passengers on canceled flights, but they will not be required to cover secondary costs such as hotels or meals for stranded travelers. This is the standard procedure when a delay or cancellation is not the fault of the carrier, such as during severe weather. The order does not require a reduction in international flights, and carriers may use their own discretion to decide which domestic flights to cancel to meet the reduction mandates. So be sure to check with your airline carrier before heading to the airport if you book to travel soon. And if you haven't yet made reservations, you may want to consider a non-stop flight. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A free press is the foundation of our democracy. KNSJ Radio is dedicated to providing nonprofit news in the public interest, not special interests. We rely on your support to continue bringing you important stories from San Diego and East County that you won't hear anywhere else. Please make a generous donation at knsj.org to sustain KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
In a powerful show of community partnership and coordination, the Jacobs and Cushman San Diego Food Bank hosted a large-scale emergency food distribution on November 1st to support 2,181 people at San Diego State's Snapdragon Stadium. In advance of the event, the food bank mobilized more than 63,000 pounds of food, equivalent to 53,500 meals, including dry goods, frozen ground turkey, eggs, and fresh nutritious produce such as yams, pears, squash, and onions. The event, hosted in collaboration with the State of California, the City of San Diego, SDSU, and the Associated Students, was organized in response to the federal government shutdown that halted CalFresh and SNAP benefits starting November 1st. A steady stream of cars and families in need at the Snapdragon event underscored the depth of this crisis. Nearly 400,000 San Diego County residents, more than 240,000 households, receive CalFresh benefits every month, including thousands of seniors, working families, and military service members. With the benefits now paused, our region faces a potential deficit of up to 16 million meals in November alone. Casey Castillo, CEO of the San Diego Food Bank, says we've been preparing for potential disruptions and were ready to act when the government shutdown began. Our team swiftly expanded operations, mobilized staff and volunteers, and activated our network of partners to meet the need. Today's effort reflects the scale of our response and the critical response of sustaining it. This marks the food bank's largest coordinated response since the height of the COVID-19 pandemic. That includes expanding distributions countywide, buying more food supplies, and activating hundreds of volunteers. San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria was at that Snapdragon Stadium food distribution. He said, "When our federal government fails to act, it's local communities that step up, and that's exactly what we're doing here in San Diego," adding, "I watched mothers and fathers with their children breathe a sigh of relief as volunteers loaded food into their cars." He voiced gratitude to Governor Gavin Newsom, the San Diego Food Bank, SDSU, and community partners for coming together so quickly to make sure neighbors don't go hungry. Governor Gavin Newsom has ordered deployment of the California Service Corps and California National Guard to food banks statewide. In addition to the food distribution, the food bank had its CalFresh team on site to answer questions and support renewals and applications, ensuring families are ready whenever the program resumes. 211 San Diego also connected attendees to additional community resources, such as the Community Information Exchange, a shared system linking social service providers to improve long-term access to support such as housing, utilities, and health care. The food bank anticipates rising demand in the coming weeks, with an estimated initial financial impact of $1.5 million and additional emergency costs ranging from $100,000 to over $300,000 each week for the duration of the federal shutdown. Even after federal funding is restored, it will take several days for CalFresh benefits to fully resume, leaving families in need of continued local support. Community members who wish to help can visit sandiegofoodbank.org to donate, host a virtual food drive, or volunteer. Individuals affected by the CalFresh disruption can also find information about local food distribution sites and resources at the same link. And again, that's sandiegofoodbank.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is East County Magazine's Crime Beat. On the streets, reporting on crimes impacting communities across our region, helping to keep you safe and informed.
This is John Tidwell with a crime beat report. A judge has set bail at $1.5 million for Danny Corcus, a 35-year-old El Cajon man who fled the scene after hitting a 12-year-old boy with his SUV, causing serious injury. The boy was in a coma initially from a head injury and also suffered other injuries requiring surgery. El Cajon police used license plate reading technology to find the SUV driven by Corcus, which was parked outside his family's business, Lakeside Smoke Shop. According to Deputy District Attorney Natalie Schofield, surveillance video indicates Corcus was aware he had hit someone. After his arrest, Corcus was initially released on a lower bail, but he failed to show up at an October 28th court hearing on a separate charge of evading police back in July. He'd been charged with reckless driving in July and again in August before the October 22nd accident on Ballantyne Street that seriously injured the 12-year-old in El Cajon. Corcus now faces additional charges, including felony hit and run. He has pleaded not guilty. Judge Peter Lynch rebuked Corcus during a hearing on November 1st for his pattern of reckless driving, evading police, and ultimately injuring a child. The judge noted that all of that could have been avoided if he simply followed the traffic laws that everybody is supposed to do. Judge Lynch set the hefty $1.5 million bail, calling the defendant clearly dangerous.
27 years after her body was found partially decomposed in a ravine off Avocado in El Cajon, Alicia Ledesma Sanchez has been identified as the homicide victim thanks to a match to DNA provided by her son. The case is a testament to the persistence of El Cajon Police Department's detectives and the department's volunteer cold case unit, which persevered over decades to solve the case. When found on August 13, 1998, beneath heavy shrubbery in the ravine, Sanchez had no identification and police were unable to identify her. She was believed to have been dead for about 6 weeks. In 2003, the death case was re-examined by the Cold Case Homicide Unit of the El Cajon Police Department. The victim's skull was retrieved and sent to a forensic artist who completed a forensic sculpture. Photographs of the sculpture were released in hopes that a member of the public could assist in identifying the woman. However, no viable leads were developed and the case remained cold. In 2008, DNA was obtained from the decedent and a DNA profile was developed, but unfortunately, there were no DNA matches in the database. Over 2 years, beginning in 2023, members of the ECPD Volunteer Cold Case Unit worked with labs to conduct genetic, genealogy, and phenotyping, advanced DNA techniques to reveal human characteristics and potential family members. In August, the El Cajon Police Department posted the victim's story on the department's social media pages, asking the public for help. The volunteer cold case unit was contacted by a potential family member who believed she knew the woman's identity. A DNA test with the son of the deceased woman confirmed in a familial match, providing identification 27 years later. The homicide remains under investigation and no suspect has yet been named. If you have any information about Alicia Ledesma Sanchez or knowledge of her death, please contact the El Cajon Police Department's Investigation Division at 619-579-3320 or email the Volunteer Cold Case Unit at coldcaseunit@elcajon.gov. Alternatively, tips can be shared anonymously through Crime Stoppers at 888-580-8477 or online at sdcrimestoppers.org. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Heidi Hope.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Caltrans has removed 2/3 of the parking spaces in front of Descanso Junction Restaurant and nearby businesses along State Route 94 in Descanso in late October, sparking anger among local business owners and some residents. The State Transportation Agency removed angled parking spaces, replacing them with far fewer parallel spots. The speed limit has also been reduced along that stretch of highway from 55 to 45 miles an hour. The highway leads to Guate, Pine Valley, Cuyamaca, Mount Laguna, Julian, and other backcountry mountain communities. In addition, signs were installed on the shoulders to remind motorists that parking is never allowed on the state highway shoulder except for emergency situations and emergency vehicles, though it's long been done in Descanso, where parking is very limited. Caltrans says the changes were made due to a January 2021 traffic accident resulting in serious injuries that occurred at Descanso Junction when a vehicle traveling south on State Route 79 struck two teenage pedestrians. Aaron Hunter, spokesman for Caltrans, told East County Magazine that in a subsequent court case, the plaintiff alleged that parking on both sides of the roadway and vehicles backing out from parking spaces contributed to dangerous conditions. He adds, this incident added a high level of urgency for safety and remedial measures. John Elliott, the owner of Descanso Trading Post across the highway from Descanso Junction, had 6 parking spaces in front of his business, and now he has just 2. He says the designated scenic highway now looks like hell. He is angry that Caltrans failed to work with the community to address concerns, and he says someone needs to be fired at Caltrans. It was wrong. It was not done properly. Elliott is a 35-year resident of Descanso, and he's also been a member of the community planning group for 30 years, and he's owned the Descanso Trading Post since 1991. He says in all that time they've been asking for a reduced speed limit, but not fewer parking spaces. Tammy Cooker has owned Descanso Junction Restaurant with her husband Brett since 2003. They had to cancel their annual Halloween party because Caltrans was doing the work at the time, painting stripes in front of their business. She asked that they put off the work for just a couple of days so they wouldn't have to cancel the party, but Caltrans refused. Now, she says, the new parking situation is affecting business because people can't figure out how to park. It's confusing. There are several other ways they could have handled this. The junction does have some parking in back, but other businesses don't have that option, and they're worried about losing customers. Cooker and Elliot are also concerned that Caltrans left no handicap parking spaces, so they are afraid they could be sued for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. They requested the speed limit be posted at 35 miles an hour, have a crosswalk painted on the highway, and a traffic signal or a stop sign installed. But that has not been done. More changes are possible, however. Hunter says Caltrans is proceeding with the community's request to evaluate a potential three-way stop at the intersection of State Route 79 and Riverside Drive. Caltrans is also in communication with state and local officials on potential long-term suggestions or improvements, such as a three-way stop evaluation and relinquishing the highway altogether. Elliot, the Descanso Trading Post owner, says that no consideration was made by Caltrans regarding pedestrian traffic in the area. He says there are no crosswalks, warning signs, sidewalks, or any other pedestrian safety actions that Caltrans has done to protect pedestrians. The only apparent action is to eliminate pedestrians by putting the local businesses out of business. No businesses, no pedestrians, he says. Connie Navarez, whose two daughters were the teenagers hit by a car back in 2021, raised concerns on social media recently about the changes. She claims Caltrans is retaliating against her family for the lawsuit and causing retribution by her Descanso neighbors. She says her house has been vandalized and damaged, causing her heavy anxiety. Navarez says it's like Caltrans is trying to create a lynch mob. What Caltrans is doing is creating unsafe roadway conditions that will ultimately lead to another accident, injury, or death. Her daughters' lives have been permanently altered with lifelong disabilities, with both needing daily assistance as adults. The Caltrans changes are personal to her. She says, I have a responsibility to this community. The community stood up for my family against everyone. They held me together. If it wasn't for them, I might not still have my home. I might not still have my daughters. Navarez's attorney issued a letter to the community in October in an effort to quell rumors spreading around Descanso, blaming her for the changes. The letter contends that Caltrans claimed the modifications were due to a court order issued related to his client's lawsuit. However, the attorney's letter states that the lawsuit did not result in any judicial order mandating roadway redesign, parking reconfiguration, or signage installation. Many in the Descanso community vow to continue the fight. The issue is on the December agenda for the San Diego County Traffic Advisory Committee meeting. Community members are working with the offices of State Senator Brian Jones, Assemblymember Carl DeMaio, and County Supervisor Joel Anderson's staff. They have also reached out to Congressman Daryl Issa about the lack of ADA parking. Descanso Junction's owner Tammy Cooker promises it's not a dead issue yet. Reporting for East County Magazine from Descanso on KNSJ, the network for social justice based in Descanso, this is Miriam Raftery.
The Grossmont Healthcare District has a new chief executive officer. Santee resident James Sly was unanimously approved by the district's five-member board to lead the organization starting November 15th. Sly, who has been the CEO of the East County Economic Development Council since December 2020, will have a salary of $270,000 a year as Grossmont Healthcare District's CEO. Aaron Bizak, who has been the interim CEO for the Grossmont Healthcare District since March 2025, will stay on as a communications strategy consultant for the Grossmont Healthcare District. A press release from the district states that Sly was selected following an exhaustive multi-month recruitment process that drew nearly 500 applicants from across the country. The process involved multiple rounds of interviews with dozens of highly qualified candidates before the board approved Sly's appointment. Grossmont Board President Bob Ayers says Sly brings, quote, the perfect blend of strategic vision, community insight, and leadership experience to guide the district into its next chapter. Ayers said Sly has been a valued partner to the healthcare district for years, helping us expand healthcare access and workforce opportunities. Before serving as CEO of the East County Economic Development Council, Sly served as the group's vice president and chief operating officer. He also helped launch the East County Small Business Development Center and previously worked in the aerospace industry and for a consulting group managing large-scale workforce and public service programs. He currently serves on more than a dozen local and regional boards, including the San Diego County Regional Airport Authority, SANDAG, the World Trade Center San Diego, and both the East County and Santee Chambers of Commerce. He previously worked as a management consultant and a workforce expert for programs including the One Stop Career Center Network and San Diego's CalWORKS Welfare to Work and Refugee Resettlement Programs. A West Hills alumni, Sly holds an MBA from Western Governors University, a bachelor's degree in business management and administration from San Diego State University, and a not-for-profit management certificate from Harvard Business School. Sly says he's honored to lead the Grossmont Healthcare District and continue its legacy of serving East County residents. Having partnered with Grossmont District for many years, he says, I've seen firsthand the district's impact on improving health access, supporting community wellness, and fostering the next generation of healthcare professionals. I look forward to building on that foundation and advancing our shared mission. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Tidwell.
Cutting-edge technology deployed in the wake of the LA fires is helping scientists understand the nature of the toxic smoke from urban wildfires. Researchers from UCLA, UC Davis, Harvard, and the University of Texas at Austin deployed what they call a sniffer van in the Pacific Palisades and Altadena for several weeks in February and May to measure air pollution in the burn zone. Chemist Pavel Mishtal, a professor at UT Austin, is using a supercomputer to analyze reams of data to identify hotspots and understand how different sources contribute to air pollution.
With every second, we see more than 1,000 different chemicals and how they change over time. So this novel way of mapping chemistry from an electric mobile van is game-changing.
Mishtal is part of the Los Angeles Fire Human Exposure and Long-Term Health Study, also known as LA Fire Health. Experts believe that toxins released in urban wildfires are potentially more carcinogenic and deadlier than smoke from other wildfires. The LA Fire Health team noticed people digging through the remnants of burned properties without proper protective equipment, breathing toxic airborne particles. Mishtal hopes this research will help local authorities guide residents as they return after future disasters.
Dilution is the solution to pollution in a way. The community needs to know when it is safe to ventilate and when it is not.
He advises homeowners to let the professionals handle remediation after a fire. They should open up and ventilate once the outdoor air has cleared, and he says people should remove anything that burned, especially from inside the house, because it can still off-gas chemicals and pollute the air for months. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The County of San Diego's Planning and Development Services is inviting all lakeside residents and community stakeholders to a public meeting to discuss local transportation needs and potential solutions. The meeting is set for Tuesday, November 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Lakeside Community Center. It's part of the Lakeside Mobility Options via Efficient Solutions, or MOVES, program, a component of the county's broader community-based transportation program. The initiative aims to collaboratively identify transportation challenges, needs, and opportunities in the local community. The resulting Lakeside Moves plan will serve as a guiding vision to enhance transportation options and accessibility throughout the Lakeside focus area. The ultimate goals are to improve mobility, safety, and connectivity for all modes of transportation. The public meeting on November 18th will provide an opportunity for community members to review and offer input on the project's goals, existing transportation conditions, and potential future improvements and programs. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news for San Diego's inland region. Now, stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine Radio Show.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Nancy D'Alessandro Pelosi will go down in history as the greatest speaker of all time. Her tenure has been iconic, legendary, historic, and transformational.
House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries is praising Nancy Pelosi, who won't seek re-election to her San Francisco district. Pelosi was the first ever woman speaker and was key to passing the Affordable Care Act. She tapped Jeffries to replace her at the top of House Democrats as the party's base pressed for younger leadership. Pelosi is 85. Centrist Maine Democratic Congressman Jared Golden says he's also retiring. President Donald Trump won his district, so it could become a target for the GOP. And close Trump ally Republican Representative Elise Stefanik says she will run for governor of New York. The FAA is allowing 10% fewer flights at major airports as unpaid air traffic controllers call in sick to already understaffed towers. Senate Majority Leader John Thune blames Democrats for impacts from the shutdown.
That means widespread flight cancellations, supply chain issues, hundreds of thousands of passengers dealing with disruptions to travel every day. The impact this will have will be immense.
A D.C. jury has acquitted a man charged with throwing a sub sandwich at a federal immigration officer. The White House says harsh enforcement against protests is justified to maintain order. But Ido Osigbovo with the Chicago Black Voter Project says everyone in that city, no matter their ethnicity, should see the need for solidarity and lawful resistance to ICE.
It's common to assume that only folks of a certain demographic are impacted, but Chicago's always been an interconnected city. So we're talking about people who share space, whether that's living space or their kids go to school together.
Postal workers across the country are encouraging municipal and county governments to come out against privatizing the USPS, something the administration may be considering. Angela Lish, an Ohio retiree active with the American Postal Workers Union, says privatization could mean the end of universal service, which would be terrible for seniors and rural residents.
Everybody should care. You know, it goes from the customers to the employees, even out of our country. Because right now we are regulated. If it's privatized, they can pretty much do what they want to do.
The American Postal Workers Union says the Postal Service doesn't get tax money and provides about 7 million jobs nationwide. Clean energy advocates are celebrating the election of Abigail Spanberger in Virginia and Mikey Sherrill in New Jersey, saying the new governors will be good news for consumers and the environment. David Kiva, with the Environmental Defense Action Fund, says they can counterbalance efforts by Trump to scale back renewable projects and encourage fossil fuels.
He's been working as hard as he possibly can to snuff out investments in clean energy just because he doesn't like windmills or solar panels. And that's hurting the American people and causing all of our bills to go up.
I'm Simone Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice. Today, our very special guest is Elisha Cecil. He is an accomplished filmmaker, director, and screenwriter from La Mesa. His films have been featured in major film festivals, including Eyes of Shadow, shown at the Horrible Imaginings Film Festival, and most recently, Amber, a short film showing at the San Diego Film Week, coming up November 14th. Elisha will be talking to us today about his journey as a director and his first full-length feature movie, The Last Job. Elisha, welcome to the show.
Hi, happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you here. And I'm also delighted to welcome Heidi Hope, our journalism intern, who's going to be interviewing Elisha.
Hi, everyone. I'm Heidi Hope. I'm happy to be here, too. All right, Elisha, please tell us, how did you get interested in becoming a director, and why did you choose this career out of everything else?
Well, I've always been into movies ever since I was a kid. You know, I think everyone's got like their first memory of like a big film they've seen or something that kind of, you know, inspired them to do what they wanted to do for the rest of their life. So that just kind of happened with me at an early age, and I got really into writing because of my dad's kind of background in English literature and all that. And, you know, from writing, the deeper you get into film, you start to realize as a writer, you don't have a lot of control over what you put on paper and all that. So it kind of became more into, okay, now I have to learn to direct if I want to see what I'm putting on the paper come to screen. And that's kind of what ultimately decided that.
So with that, what types of movies do you like to make?
It's usually genre pieces. Like, I really love Paul Verhoeven, who did, like, RoboCop and Starship Troopers and all that. So a lot of sci-fi work, some horror work, but it's not as fun as sci-fi work to me. And, you know, action movies and all that stuff. I've always loved, you know, a lot of films from the 80s that dealt with, you know, just fun stuff.
So what is your goal after becoming a director? What do you wish to do?
Just keep creating. I'm not like a great businessman and all that, so I've never seen myself becoming like a producer or anything, but, you know, just continued making art and, you know, hopefully just entertaining people down the line somewhere.
That's nice. So for the genre you're currently making, why did you pick it? And what was your goal for picking these types of movies to make?
You know, like I said, I've always had kind of a passing interest in horror, which is kind of what the last job is. It's a horror kind of mixed with crime, which I've always liked too in movies. Everyone loves a good gangster movie. And horror was really just something I picked because it's very easily producible when you don't have any money when you're working in film. Yeah, that's always been why horror films always get made, because they're cheap to make, they're cheap to produce, and even if they're not good, people still want to see them because, you know, they're still entertaining to watch. So,
wow, mind-boggling.
Yeah, so it's a great genre to kind of have your start out in. A lot of great directors that work today all started out in the genre, so that's kind of why I picked that one specifically.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, that's mind-boggling. I've never heard that before, Elisha. Thank you for sharing. Wow, I should try to watch horror movies from now on. So was there anything you think you would like to do differently throughout your journey to become a director?
No, not really. I think if there were any like things to change, is just in the way the feature was produced. Don't ever use your own money to finance your movies, basically. I think that's kind of like a rule that, you know, even Francis Ford Coppola talked a lot about, and he was making his films in the 70s when he self-financed Apocalypse Now and almost bankrupted him. So wow. That's kind of just like a huge one. I would always, like, you know, at least point out to filmmakers trying to make a feature is just...
Yeah, don't mortgage your house to pay for the filmmaking.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, have a budget, someone... And lending you the bill, not your own bill.
Exactly. And don't stop paying the rent just to make a movie. Mm-hmm. So, Elisha, please tell us, what was your vision for Amber and your vision for The Last Job?
Amber was actually just a film that was kind of made with me and my friend Jaron Hempel, my regular collaborator. We did that film together. It's just kind of like it started out as kind of like a throwback, like 70s, like kind of exploitation stalker film, but it kind of turned more into something different, kind of talking about the very nature of... you know, how certain people, like women and all that, don't feel safe walking home at night. So that's the nature of that film. And The Last Job, it's just, you know, it's something I've been noticing with people, is it's hard to make a check right now. A lot of people, you know, are, you know, having a hard time out there. And there's a lot of people, you know, doing not such nice things to each other to make sure they get ahead monetarily wise. So it basically, there are a lot of films that we make just based on, you know, how we're feeling at the moment. And I think everyone else kind of shares the same feeling.
So you're saying these movies are made according to these spontaneous feelings?
Not spontaneous, just kind of what I think the shared consciousness that everyone feels at the time. A lot of people are, you know, worried about finances, and a lot of people are worried about, you know, if they can pay mortgage next month. So that was kind of the idea behind The Last Job. And Amber was just, you know, we wrote it right after COVID and was kind of feeling powerless. So we kind of made a film about, you know, people that feel powerless, which is you're walking home alone at night to your home and you don't have any way to defend yourself. So
very surprising.
Yeah.
I'm excited to watch them. So in terms of these two movies, why did you give them these names? Like, why did you call Amber Amber, and why did you call The Last Job The Last Job? What are the meanings behind the movies?
I mean, my frequent collaborator Jaron Hempel, he's always laughing. He's like, they're not good titles, but it's just kind of what we went with. Amber, you know, obviously it's named after the Amber Alert, which is, you know, famously what goes off when someone goes missing. So that's why we named that film that. And then The Last Job, it just was kind of sounding like a fun, snappy title to me, because at its heart, it is still a crime film with, you know, colorful characters and all that are, you know, kind of shady, but kind of fun still to follow. So, wow. And it is a last job, basically, that happens in the film. It's not just a pretty title.
Wow, this is very intriguing. I would love to see the whole thing. So what did you aim to accomplish from these two movies?
Well, you know, even though we're still making movies and having fun, it would be nice to kind of get noticed and all that. And it's getting a lot harder right now in the industry. There's not a lot of people working right now. And then AI kind of taking over. It's just been kind of fun to really set out and make films that are all very made, like in camera, in frame, and with human hands and all that. So that was kind of just our big accomplishment with that. And, you know, they're all made with other people that I find really talented and really respect as other artists. So it's just been kind of a collective movement to get, you know, other talented art all put together into these cool little movies.
Well, that also sounds very inspiring to me. Like, I appreciate how you recognize the good in other people and how you guys build connection to bring this art into the real world. So yeah. I cannot wait to see them. How did you manage the casting process for these two movies respectively, Elisha? How did you audition and pick your actors? And why did you choose these actors for the cast?
Well, for Amber, it was something that was written with like a specific kind of thing in mind where me and Jaren talked a lot about, you know, we like writing. The character was supposed to feel like someone that wasn't human trying to pretend to be human. And we just so happened to both have a friend that wasn't really an actress, but she could kind of perceive that. And she talked a lot about it with, you know, she was from Brazil and she tells us a lot about, you know, how she felt like a foreigner trying to be American basically and try to hide, you know, exactly who she was and all that. So that was kind of an empathy that fell into that character that I felt like worked. And then with this new film, The Last Job, it was actually two friends that were written with the roles in mind already. They were both actresses that were kind of out, you know, not working because of the strikes happening last year with SAG. And then they were willing to work as long as they liked the script. So we wrote a script, they were cool with it, and they really liked it. And they also kind of felt like it, you know, worked out both personality-wise. One's very serious and kind of a dramatic actor, so she had the dramatic role. One's a comedian, so she had the sillier role, and that can kind of convey comedy. So it's kind of in between, you know, with how we picked those two roles.
Well, to me, this sounds very surreal, and I like how like there is a connection, a personal connection, like throughout the casting process. And I love how like people like in this group, like they strengthen the connection further just by casting and working together to make the movie. So, so Elisha, how do you decide when a script is ready to be turned into a movie or not?
It's really kind of a gut feeling, because I don't think a script's ever really finished. And even when we're filming, we're still actively rewriting. Not to the extent like, you know, like, oh, I have nothing and I'm just shooting to see what happens. But like with Amber, that was just kind of an ever-evolving creature that just came off of, you know, like an idea. And that was kind of very touch and go. And then The Last Job was more like that took weeks and weeks and weeks of rewrites because it was going to be a feature. So we had to be a little bit more careful with that. We had a bigger crew, so we didn't want to, you know, waste people's time. But, you know, then you come across things on set where you can't exactly get exactly what's on the page. And then you just got to be good at, you know, being able to change and evolve just with what happens and what you're given.
That's very inspiring how you guys can be so flexible and manage the workaround really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, Elisha, how do you distribute each movie and what's your distribution and release process like?
Well, Amber was a little more loosey-goosey. We threw it out on YouTube and it got like a thing close to 2,000 views and all that just based on, you know, who saw it and, you know, kind of the marketing we did on social media. And then that ended up getting picked up on, you know, the festival circuit. So we had to, you know, take that one off YouTube and start having that one only seen in theaters. So that one's kind of going through the festival circuit right now. Last Job, we're still waiting to see. Like, we have a couple of interested parties that work at, like, Blumhouse and some other, like, big horror, like, studios. So that'll be based on, you know, if these guys like the movie. and kind of what we do with distribution on that one. So we'll see.
Well, Elisha, I'm excited either way. And I'm sure someone is going to like it. And I'm excited to see Amber. I'm going to go catch it in the theater immediately. So, Elisha, most importantly, how do you get sufficient funding for each of your movies?
Well, Amber, that was out of pocket because it was such a small film. Like, it was 7 minutes long and it took us like 3 weeks to make, so that wasn't too bad. The Last Job was a mixture of me, my partner Jaren's own self-funding, which again I don't recommend to do. But that one, we also had an Indiegogo for that one, so that paid for, like, you know, everyone's meals for the whole week, which, you know, if you guys ever want to make a film and you're not paying actors, at least pay them, or at least feed them, you know, because it's like the very least you could do. So at least with that, we had our food covered, and then we had like an Airbnb covered because a lot of our talent were from LA and they had to have a place to stay. So crowdfunding too, like, that's kind of the future with filmmaking right now. I mean, I know the Terrifier films were all crowdfunded, so don't ever look down on that.
That's very sweet of you guys. Mm-hmm. I wish I could be in a cast like that. So now tell us, now that The Last Job is coming to an end and Amber's getting released, so what's your upcoming plan after The Last Job is completely finished?
Me and my partner Jaren actually had a whole conversation in the drive down about what was next. He's got a couple ideas that he's kind of itching to shoot up in Arizona where he's at, which would be really fun. I got a few ideas I kind of want to shoot in LA. So it's kind of just based on like what we're feeling we want to do. Like, I don't think we want to take something as complicated as the last job with so many moving parts, but something definitely that kind of ups it and is bigger than the last job. So
how exciting. I cannot wait to see what they are. Like, I want to watch whatever you guys are making next. And when and where can the audience catch these movies in the movie theater?
Yeah, so Amber will be playing November 14th at San Diego Film Week, part of the horror block. I would recommend going on the website soon because tickets are selling out on that one. Yeah, I mean, it usually depends on, like, if tickets sell, then they'll continue with the showcase for that one. And that one's doing pretty well, so go get your tickets while there's seats available.
Also, Elijah, can you tell us, is there a website or a place where people can go and learn more about you and your film?
Yeah, so I have a Wix site. It's ecsil95 at wix.com. I got reels and stuff, but I also have social media. This is where really people find me. I got Tokyo Cop Films on Instagram, and then Elijah Cecil Draws if you want to see some of my art. But yeah, the films are on Tokyo Cop. So
very cool.
And listeners, if you just turned in, we've been speaking with Elijah Cecil, a filmmaker located right here in East County, who has a film coming up at the San Diego Film Week, and it's called Amber.
We are out of time for today, but I really want to thank you for joining us today on the East County Magazine radio show on KNSJ 89.1 FM, Descanso. And if you missed that website or you want to learn more about Elijah Cecil, we will be putting up an article and the audio from this interview on our website, which you can find at eastcountymagazine.org. Thank you both for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having us. Thank you for having me. Thank you for tuning in, everyone. Have a great weekend.
Appreciate it. Seriously.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Destination East County, bringing you all of the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County each week.
This is Miriam Raftery bringing you some notable events coming up for the rest of November in San Diego's East County. Lamplighters Theater in La Mesa continues its performances of the Tony Award-winning play Copenhagen, November 1st at 7:30 and again on November 8th and 9th at 2 p.m. The play explores an explosive confrontation inspired by actual events that have intrigued and baffled historians for more than 50 years, a 1941 meeting between two brilliant physicists, Niels Bohr of Denmark and Germany's Werner Heisenberg. The two men, whose work together opened the way to the atomic bomb, were now on opposite sides of World War II after once being friends. This pivotal meeting was a defining moment of the nuclear age, yet its true nature remains a mystery. For tickets and details, visit lamplighterslamesa.com. Members of the San Diego Astronomy Association invite you to enjoy stargazing at Mission Trails Regional Park on the first Friday of each month, starting at dusk. The next stargazing event is November 7th. Meet at the far end of the Kumeyaay Lake Campground's day-use parking lot to view the nighttime sky through telescopes, weather permitting. For more information, you can visit Mission Trails Regional Park's website at mtrp.org. The Olaf Weghorst Museum and Western Heritage Center in El Cajon will host its first annual fashion show fundraiser, Boots and Bells, on November 8th from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. This event will feature designs of local artist and designer Don Howe Seabaugh, whose Walla collection blends the color, creativity, and Western spirit that defines our community. In addition to models wearing fashionable designs, the event will also feature a silent auction, cocktail fair, wine, and soft drinks. Located in the heart of the Art District in El Cajon, the museum stands as a tribute to the artist whose vivid portrayals of the American West captured the spirit of a bygone era. Olaf Weghorst not only painted the West, but he also lived it, working as a cowboy across the West before settling in El Cajon. Known as the Dean of Western Art, his work has been displayed in the Oval Office by four American presidents. For tickets and reservations, you can visit weghorstmuseum.org, and that's spelled W-I-E-G-H-O-R-S-T, weghorstmuseum.org. Circle TLC Ranch Equine Therapy in Lakeside will hold its 14th annual chili cook-off on Saturday, November 8th from 1 p.m. to 4 p.m. The event benefits Circle TLC Ranch's equine therapy programs, which provide a safe space for children, teens, and adults who have experienced trauma, abuse, mental illness, or personal struggles. For details, you can visit CircleTLCRanch.com. The La Mesa History Center features its 19th annual home tour on Saturday, November 8th. Titled Golden Gems of La Mesa, this year's tour features classic homes in and around La Mesa's downtown village. Experience some of La Mesa's most historic, beautiful, and preserved La Mesa gems, including a 1910 landmark recently confirmed as a design of world-famous San Diego architect Irving J. Gill. Ticket holders will also experience the works of other noted architects. A shuttle bus will transport guests to each historic home. This tour does sell out quickly. You can get tickets at lamesahistory.com. The City of Santee hosts its holiday tree lighting on Friday, November 21st from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. at the Santee Trolley Square. The tree will be lit up at 6:15. Other activities will include sledding, face painting, live music, and photos with Santa. Parking is limited, so using the trolley's copper line is recommended. You can get details at cityofsantee.gov and just click on the calendar. Al Hardeen, one of the original Beach Boys, brings his Pet Sounds band to the Magnolia in El Cajon on November 22nd at 6:30 p.m. The event will be a tribute to the late Brian Wilson, Beach Boys founder. The concert will include performances of classic Beach Boys hits such as California Girls, I Get Around, Sloop John B., Surfin' USA, and Fun, Fun, Fun. Music that helped define the California sounds of summer. For tickets, you can visit MagnoliaSanDiego.com. The first ever Spring Valley 5K community run, stroll, and kids sprint will start at 7:30 a.m. at Spring Valley Canyon south of the Spring Valley Swap Meet on Thanksgiving Day, November 27th. Registration is required by November 20th. This event benefits the Spring Valley Community Alliance. For information and to register or volunteer, you can visit GoSpringValley.com. You can walk, waddle, or trot off those Thanksgiving calories at the Mount Helix Park Turkey Trot, held on November 28th, the Friday after Thanksgiving at 10 a.m. Meet at the fire station on Rivera to join the community walk to the park at the top of Mount Helix. For details, you can visit MountHelixPark.org. That's MTHelixPark.org. Bates Nut Farm and Valley Center will host a craft fair holiday market on Friday and Saturday, November 28th and 29th from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Santa will visit between 12:30 and 2:30 when you and your family can enjoy Polar Express tractor hay rides with Santa and take photos. Other activities include face painting, pony rides, live music, food, and shopping from vendors of handcrafted goods just in time for the holidays. For details, visit batesnutfarm.biz. Julian hosts its annual Country Christmas and Tree Lighting on November 29th from noon to 7 p.m. Enjoy live music all day, plus shopping at a Christmas market with over 20 vendors. You can also stroll along Julian's historic downtown to shop at the many boutiques. The tree lighting takes place in Pioneer County Park in front of the Julian Pioneer Museum. Santa arrives at 6 to visit with the children. You'll feel a nip in the air, catch the aroma of wood fires, and maybe catch a glimpse of snow-capped mountains surrounding the former gold mining town. Get details at visitjulian.com. You're invited to kick off the holiday season at Holiday Lights in downtown El Cajon on Saturday, November 29th from 4 p.m. to 8 p.m. in Prescott Park. This event features festive fun for the whole family, including trackless train rides, live music, holiday vendors, a business walkabout with prizes, photos with Santa, and more. You can get details at downtownelcajon.com. That's all for this week. We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Miriam Raftery with a Green Scene Report. On November 3rd, students at Sweetwater Springs Elementary School participated in a unique post-Halloween event aimed at reducing organic waste and promoting environmental education. Hosted by I Love a Clean San Diego in partnership with the County of San Diego and Waste Management, the Pumpkin Smash event gave students the opportunity to responsibly dispose of their Halloween pumpkins while learning about composting and sustainability. According to the U.S. Department of Energy, over 1 billion pumpkins are discarded in landfills every year. When organic waste like pumpkins is buried without access to oxygen, it has the potential to release methane, a potent greenhouse gas that is known for contributing to climate change. Composting offers a sustainable alternative, transforming waste into valuable resources like soil and energy. Students arrived at school with their leftover pumpkins and jack-o'-lanterns in hand, ready to smash them in a specially provided organics disposal bin. Waste Management donated the bin and hauling service, ensuring that all collected pumpkins would be transported to the county's Otay Mesa compost facility, where they will be composted and repurposed into nutrient-rich soil. Bryce Jacobowski, Waste Recovery Manager for I Love a Clean San Diego, says events like Pumpkin Smash are a fun and impactful way to teach kids about the importance of proper organic waste disposal. By diverting pumpkins from the landfill, we're not only reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but also empowering the next generation to be environmental stewards, he says. San Diego County residents can help reduce landfill waste by placing unpainted, undecorated pumpkins in their green organics bin. For more information on upcoming events or how to properly dispose of organic waste, you can visit cleansd.org.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Trade wars and the long government shutdown are hitting farmers hard. Tariffs on China crashed the price of soybeans when the largest U.S. export market retaliated by turning to other suppliers. China may reverse that move, but the import taxes are still raising the cost of inputs like fertilizer at a time when commodity prices were already collapsing. Jesse Womack is with the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition.
We are watching a lot of our leaders in this country totally ignore how difficult producers have it right now, really neglect their duty to make tools and services readily available and easy to use.
Iowa grain and livestock farmer Wendy Johnson usually visits her local USDA office this time of year to verify her land conservation contract and get paid. But the shutdowns closed that office, and Johnson says there are thousands of farmers caught in the same vice.
When you're removing those cost-share opportunities while simultaneously putting tariffs into place, they're asking for an explosion.
The fate of two young children remains unknown after they and their father were detained by ICE in rural southwest Colorado. Alana Newman reports.
Fernando Jaramillo Solano was driving his 12 and 14-year-old children to school last month when immigration agents took them all into custody, mistaking the man for someone else. The family's from Colombia, but has stayed here with a pending asylum claim. Overnight, a crowd that included Ellie Miller gathered to protest outside the ICE facility. As she explained her reasons for participating, there were cries of people calling for the family's release.
It's important because due process is being ignored. A bunch of constitutional rights are being ignored.
As ICE agents prepared to move them to detention in Texas, Miller says federal agents used force and chemical agents to subdue the crowd.
I don't want to see any kids taken away from their families and sent to who knows where.
The father is not accused of any crimes. I'm Ilana Newman.
From the Austin blind salamander to the toothless blind cat, aquatic species help keep Texas water safe. The seven at-risk critters have thin, absorbent skin, making them sensitive to environmental changes that alert scientists to potential ecosystem problems. Azalea Rodriguez-Veith with Defenders of Wildlife calls them the Texas treasures.
They're, so to speak, like an environmental barometer or like the canary in the coal mine.
Human population growth has pushed them close to extinction, but Rodriguez-Veith's group still regularly uses them to check the health of water bodies, sending the findings to state environmental officials.
So they have a set standard of where it should be at, what is considered, quote unquote, the normalcy of water quality.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, AK Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine Radio Show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show.